you go to the doctor's office or to your massage therapist and look at that, you know, the body standing there without the fascia on it, and you see the muscles, and it's all got the shape and everything there. And poof, so imagine it, please, with all the organs. Imagine it fully, you know, with whatever you have in mind of the way animals are built inside. Put all that in there underneath the muscles and everything, and then all the brain and everything else, and then poof, I want you to imagine it go away. But there's like a ghost there. The shape is still retained. And in fact, all of that stuff that you were just thinking of, none of that stuff is responsible for the shape, other than the bones, which are really just spacers. The real thing that we're talking about here is that ghost. What makes that shape? Well, it is a fascinating, fascinating structure. Today on the VanCast, the first thing that I want to do is say thank you, not to you, the listener, but to the authors of this paper that I'm going to review in the section on fascia today. It is a review paper in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences. Just hang on, listeners, you'll get your thanks. So it's a review paper in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences entitled A Closer Look at the Cellular and Molecular Components of the Deep/Muscular Fascia. I would say the authors' names, but I think they're mostly Italian, and I really just do not know. So in lieu of that, I just want to say to each of you that I thank you personally for helping me to understand more about my condition, and more importantly, as it's still ongoing, kind of what's happening to me as I, you know, perform my own experiments on myself. So I really thank you for studying this new system, the fascial system, for our species. Listeners, I thank you for your time and consideration today, and I hope you find this episode helpful for you in some way. All rights reserved, Steve Coleman in the Origami VanCast. The Origami VanCast is an audio podcast resource for the chronic pain patient, and is for those who suffer from ill-defined, sometimes referred to as throwaway diagnoses. Basically, if the cause of your disease is not well understood by current medicine, let me tell you about a couple of fundamental systems within your body that your doctor wasn't educated about in med school. These systems are the endocannabinoid system and the fascial systems, and both are the subject of current ongoing research. As a patient who has suffered due to the ignorance of both of these systems, I don't want anyone else to suffer unnecessarily. I quit my six-figure job designing lasers and moved into a van in order to finish curing myself, and now I feel obligated to try to highlight the new and important research in these fields, adding whatever value my experience might to the work of the scientists. But what I wanted to do with the little section right here is just kind of encourage you on your journey, I guess, with a little bit of maybe discouraging information. Everyone's on their own personal struggle, on their own path of self-improvement, and I think we need to honor that path. And I know that I beat myself up a lot for my failures all throughout my engineering life and everything. But to make it through this phase and to get off of drugs like fentanyl, I have had to be a lot more generous with myself. And so I want to encourage you on your journey that if you fall down, if you stumble, if you have a setback, if you if you're an addict and you use again, if you are not exercising like you should and you sit down for a few weeks, if you are trying to stick to a diet and don't, or overeat in that diet, whatever your situation is, I think what I can say from my experience, the best thing is to honor how you got there, acknowledge the situation for what it is, and try to manipulate yourself and your environment to give you the outcome that you desire. There are many ways to achieve the same ends in almost all aspects of life. And by allowing us to see our goal, but not the path, and to kind of forget about the path, it allows us to imagine a new path. And that's where I want to get to today. Hello, world. Welcome to the Origami Vancast. I'm Steve Coleman. Today the Vancast is coming to you from beautiful southern Arizona near the town of Oatman, in an area full of these fluorescent yellow cacti. I have the most spectacular mountain valley to myself. And, you know, I've enjoyed, I've had to do some work on my kitchen here. I had a failure that I've known basically for a year was going to happen. But it was pretty catastrophic, and my kitchen is a large portion of the van needed to be fixed here. Luckily, that's no big deal if you just carry all your tools everywhere. So, you know, I had to go all the way, you know, from the deck out to the garage, but, you know, it's not very far when you live in a van. So, yeah, maybe I'll put, if you see some pictures, my new kitchen it's a pretty heavily modified mechanics tool cart. And then I took the old swiveling mechanism for the countertop that, I don't know, was 4 or 5 feet long, and cut a chunk out of it. Yeah, so it's a little bit of a new setup. Anyways, whatever. That's probably not why you're tuning in. So, all right. And today, for chronic pain purposes, the show's the Vancast is now going to have 3 segments. There's going to be a chronic pain segment. I'm assuming it's always going to be first, but who knows? Maybe some others where it'll be better to put the other ones up front. And then the next section will be on fascia. Or the fascial system, you know, have something to do with fascia. Yeah, that would include, I've mentioned before, the tensegrity model, those sorts of things. So anything, you know, that has to do with the fascial systems. And then the third segment is going to be on cannabis, medicinal cannabis. It's not going to be like cannabis culture or anything other than, because I don't know anything about that. But it's other than like usage and things, and, you know, I think I'm getting probably pretty far behind the times, and technology moves really fast in cannabis. I'm going to try and first get everyone started out, because I know that a lot of people have not boarded the cannabis train and would like to, and I at least like to help them be a little more or less comfortable, at least more knowledgeable on cannabis. In the last episode, I asked you to begin to envision what your wellness would look like and put that on Instagram, whether that was playing with your grandkids, or whether you put it on Instagram or not, but whether it was playing with your grandkids, perhaps being able to road bike 25 miles, whatever it is, whatever your goals might be that are wellness to you, I asked you to flesh those out. If you're a chronic pain patient and you have had one of these throwaway diagnoses for 5 years and you've been in pain management for 5 years, you know, I hate to tell you this, but medicine has given up on you. If you don't think they have, make sure that they just not taking your money. I mean, are you really going to pay to have someone attach something to your spinal cord or get anywhere near that? Anyway, I'm a vertebrate animal, and I value my spine. That was the last resort, letting someone touch that for me. And I had a three-level cervical fusion, 4 vertebrae in my neck from C3 through 6 in 2013 after many years. But anyway, I'm getting way off track here, and I apologize for that. I wanted to get into the headspace, and I kind of talk about this in another one. The healing's going to come from inside of you. And I think, you know, that's sort of the thing that this podcast is really just going to inherently understand, that healing is from the inside. We really don't know nearly what we think we do about the way the human body works and the way that it heals, I don't think.
And it's these ideas that healing comes from the inside and that healing is body-wide that really means that other people can't truly help you. You really need to take responsibility yourself and take ownership for it. Otherwise, at least in my case, I was not going to get better.
We've had this variety of medicine for where we have medicines that shoot bullets at these individual diseases and symptoms for, 100 years? And in the meantime, you know, our evolution, you know, they say that we're about 200,000 years old, this model of human. I like to think that we were living through all of these same things. You know, there's nothing that abruptly changed. So to the extent that we do look at medications and things, I think it makes sense to look at something like plant medicines where they have, you know, an entourage effect. And also, you know, perhaps hundreds of thousands or more years of usage in, you know, recorded and non-recorded human history. Surely our interaction with plants has been very intimate for a very long time, as evidenced by our existence, agriculture, houseplants, whatever you want. Anyway, this is all kind of hindsight rationalization. I didn't really, when I quit my job and sold everything, I didn't exactly know what was going on with me when I divorced my wife, when I walked away from her for the last time. I didn't know that I was for sure going to be able to pull off living this lifestyle, to pull off, you know, going around the country till I found a place that sold and identified what it was in the cannabis that was helping me. I didn't know when I wrote the description on LinkedIn of what was happening to me that these scientists would then publish data that supported what I was saying. And even after, when I walked away from New Hampshire there, that was 18 months of continuous improvement. And that was the really, really radical stuff, where it was massive breakages and these huge floods of fluid. And it was really intense. But I just, you know, I didn't know where it went. And it's 18 months later now.
And I guess what I'm trying to get at here is that this mental image, it serves many purposes. It gives you, you know, a guide star to point your ship at as you, you know, aim for the future. But it also gives you something to think about and a goal in your mind when times are hard and when you have to do the many, many things that really do suck to change your life in a way such that you get better.
Hey, so I feel like I know you a lot less than you know me at this point, but I'm still here to talk to you about what I think you should do. So yeah, that's some kind of presumption, yeah. But here's the thing. If you're you know, a chronic pain patient and you spend all the time to get to here, I can tell you that you're serious about, I think you seriously want to get better. And the reason why you need to form this image in your head is so that your mind has some alternative of the future that you've scripted and your whole narrative around your life that you've been living, the way that you see it. This is sort of the prison of our minds that we tend to forget what the possibilities are. And you're like, but Steve, I've got a spinal cord injury. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Like, you have continued to build a prison on top of your condition that, well, at least in my case, and I shouldn't really speak like I know anything about you, but I feel like if you've listened this far, we must know each other a little better than I've let on. But the change needs to come from inside you,
And a lot of it is expectation. And I know it seems crazy, and again, you know, but a spinal cord injury, it's not a cause or effect thing. It's sort of just the way things work. We have to imagine an alternative. So really, let's get detailed. And if you want to play with those grandkids, then I want to know exactly how you want to play with them. What time of the day, you know? What games are you going to play? Are they going to be cool with that? Are your expectations serious? Like, let's take some of this free time that you have right now and really flesh out and detail out this scenario in your head. And please just go down all the rabbit holes. And I think that's one of the things that cannabis is helpful for, because the one thing it does is make your mind go down rabbit holes, as this podcast itself is evident. So listen, if I gave myself this advice a few years ago, I would have totally said bullshit, and I would have dismissed me. I don't think I would have taken me seriously. So I get it. And I know that a lot of this material so far has already been really questionable, and you're like, I don't know, do I want to take advice from this guy? And I ask that you not take my advice. I'm not giving you any advice. What I'm telling you is sort of my experience and what I think you should do to kind of replicate that experience and avoid some of the pitfalls where possible. Anyway, I hope that's useful to you. And if you're still listening after this show, I assume that it is. So let's get an image imagined in that dusty old meat computer between your ears. And get something together and throw it up on Instagram and give it the hashtag #NoOneCaresOGVC. And I look forward to seeing what inspiring things you would like to do and how you're going to change, you know, your grandkids' lives or whatever it is by what you're going to do when you get better. So detail that out and let's throw it up. Doesn't have to be some narcissistic quest to be the first one to do some stupid thing. It doesn't have to be anything that would change anyone's life but yours. And that's enough. It was enough for me. So anyway, I hope you'll do it, and I really look forward to seeing what's out there. The first, you know, question is, you know, what does better look like to you? That's why, you know, I've been talking about three questions, and that's the vision that I want you to come up with here and put on Instagram. And then the next question is, assume that you do get this. Assume that you can go road bike that 25 miles and not be in the horrendous pain and everything. What would you be willing to do to achieve that? Would you be willing to change your diet? Would you be willing to never eat candy? Would you be willing to stop drinking soda? Whatever it is that you do, probably whatever it is that's your biggest habit, like the thing that you have to do, like whatever that is, let's stop that first. Would you be willing to do that? I mean, if so, let's just do it. Also put it on the list. And now what we need to do here is find, actually, what is shorter, what will be shorter is for you to just tell me what you won't do. You know, butt stuff. All right, just go ahead and put that down then. What else? You know, I said that intentionally, and I'm serious. Whatever it is, and if it's butt stuff, put it down. And if it's not butt stuff, then don't put it down. And I'm serious, like, how bad do you want to get better? This is what the question is. And you need to be serious with yourself, because that's all we're doing here. I don't have any tricks for you people other than for you people. <It's>, you people. That's not what I mean. I don't have any tricks for anyone else, you know. It's just simply all I can say is looking straight ahead, clear-eyed, forward exactly at what is going on and fixing it. It sucks. It sucks, especially in this era. Oh my God, you can wish away whatever problem you want.
but not for real. Fentanyl will not wish your pain away. Your body just, at least my body, just wouldn't have it. It said, nope, sorry, man. I still will give you pain when I want to. Anyway. Butt stuff. What else is on the list? So what won't you do? I will not divorce my wife. Yeah, I thought that, but listen, if that's one of your things, we can put it on the side. You don't have to talk about it. You don't have to write it down, but husband or wife, number one, going forward, if you're going to get better 5 years in, I'm assuming you're not going to get better. Medicine's not going to help you. That's just going to be the experience of millions and millions of just Americans. You're in it for yourself. At least you need to be prepared. So I don't mean to be doom and gloom about that, but what I'm saying is that should not be an impediment to you getting better. Don't even think about your marriage. Whether it survives or not will not matter when you're better. I promise you. I promise you. So I said there were three questions, and I haven't in any of this tape, I don't think yet, gotten to the third one. And it's sort of the trickiest one, and I'm not even exactly sure what to call it. In some versions of this, I've called it, do you accept the charges? Are you ready for unintended consequences? But this one, so it's kind of the most nebulous, but what happens is every component of your life, every person that you know, every single thing in it is some, if you're 5 years in, your life is fully built around your pain and your condition. And your entire prison is built, your prison is built out of all, small pieces out of each of these individual people and habits and even medications that you take and things that you own and things that you do. Each one has its own little role to play in the thing that's preventing you from getting better to the extent that you can. And you can't know what these are. You can maybe know what a few of them are if you really sat down and think about it and you go, you know what? My grandkids aren't going to like that, and if I try and force it, and then you can go through a few different scenarios maybe, and you can come up with some things. And those are the sorts of things that I'm talking about. But with every facet of your life, and you can't anticipate this, not fully. And this is an acceptance piece, really, this third question. Do you accept the charges? Because if you do not, and you will not accept the charge, if you, if there's something that you can't do, that's, a component of this prison, then, and it's something that can't be resolved, then you won't get better. At least that's my experience. And I don't know how else to put it. I don't mean it quite literally, but you really gotta have a realistic view of things to at least heal yourself in the manner that I have, in a, let's call it an empirical way. I don't like throwing around the word scientific. It's kind of lame. But empirically, I haven't died yet, and I'm a lot better. okay. So I can delete that part out or not, but the point being here that there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences, and a lot of
a lot of things that you're going to have to do that suck, that you didn't anticipate. And you can just go, you know what? That sucks too much, man. I mean, let me tell you in my case. So I'm sitting there. It's cold, February, New Hampshire winter. And I've been recovering now and figuring out, you know, I'm pretty sure that CBG's what's in the marijuana flower that I've been getting, and you know, the breakup that I'm getting seems to correlate with that. So I'm thinking, okay, it's something to do with the CBG and the neprenol. And I know that, you know, it definitely depends on how and when I take the neprenol and how effective it is. Been having a series of, you know, really particularly bad fights with my then wife, and finally, you know, I'm sure, you know, I could go back and look at my notes maybe even and figure out what was going on, but probably I you know, was realizing that that the CBG and everything, I can make this work, but I need to do the stretching that I've been doing. And it's going to take, at this rate of change that I've been getting, I remember I was getting some things tearing throughout my femur and my hips, and or my legs and my hips. It's pretty crazy. I was like, man, at this rate of change, look at how much I've gotten better. I figure I've got like another 18 months at least to go. And that's if I stretch for like 10 hours a day. That's like if I quit my job and figure this out and go. And that was maybe like the first time that I had sort of a realization of that's what I should do. And then it just started being, well, okay, why don't I do that? Well, I got this wife that won't speak to me, does not want to be around me. I'm paying enormous sums of money to have that house, to have the backyard. The dog bit me in the face, which cost me thousands out of my own, you know, earned revenue, you know, again. And so you look at it and you go, well, all right, I need to get better. And all of these things are major inhibiting factors. And if I get rid of them, I'll have a lot more runway to take care of myself. And the thing that's important is myself. The most important thing in my life is myself. And until I realized that, and until I acted accordingly, there was no way. I mean, think about it. I had to take full time and tend to this for basically a year and a half to get to, you know, I mean, it's actually been a little bit longer. But to do that while I was working like I was, you know, which were 50-hour weeks, not including the 15 hours of commuting a week, so call it a 65-hour week, and that's weeks whenever I wasn't traveling to California. That also assumes kind of, you know, pretty okay traffic, so any traffic at all would add hours to that per week. So there's really just no path for me to get done in the course of many years. And I started thinking about it, you know, by the time I get done with that, I'll be an engineer, and maybe I'll have this, you know, these entities in my house that, you know, can't stand me. And, you know, so what am I doing here? I am working 65-hour weeks to clothe, feed, shelter, provide transportation, medical care, and everything else. And I'm doing all that, and I'm providing all that at the expense of not taking care of myself and of not curing my own condition. Hope it's not that way for you. And, you know, I sure didn't think it was that way for me. But anyway, you know, that's my personal situation, and that's quite a bit more sharing maybe than I should do. And maybe I'll delete all this off, or maybe I'll leave it. But I guess what I'm trying to get at with this third question is, this is just another way that's going to stop you. my point is that it doesn't really matter what shuts you down. It matters if it will shut you down. And so what I'm trying to elucidate with these questions, what I'm trying to explain, what I'm trying to bring about and get you thinking about, is all this unexpected stuff is going to happen when you do get better. And I think you can get a little bit better if you do what I say. And I think if you follow, kind of get into this headspace, you won't need to do what I say. You will, you don't need my advice. You'll just know what to do. And I'm just here to coach you and give you the confidence and the guidance to trust in yourself and to understand what it is that you feel in yourself, both physically, you know, emotionally, whatever, to whatever extent I can, is really what I mean by that. And if that's bearing my whole ass and soul, it wouldn't be the first time for anybody that knows me, so might as well do it for the whole freaking world, right?
He wants to call it what? Stretchy bits. Sounds naughty.
So, I think about a year after I moved to New Hampshire, I found a chiropractor, Dr. Ron Aragona, he had treatment plans where you could see him every day, and I pretty much did. I think, on average for about 5 years, I saw him for probably four days a year. And Dr. Aragona, his doctoral research was in the mechanics of the human spine, and so he has spent he's devoted his career to studying the spine, and you couldn't ask for more of an expert to treat you. So in the course of those treatments, I learned about the deformities in my back because we have X-rays of them to see them. And I learned what it was like for them to go into place. And I kind of trained my body to feel that better feeling of getting them where they're supposed to be. The problem with the chiropractic that I found was that it always went back out, sometimes immediately, almost as soon as I flexed or got off the table. So after all that time, eventually I ended up being in enough pain, things just went south all at once, there was so much pressure in my head and my neck at that time that had been building over years and years. I don't like talking about it too much, but there was a lot of pressure. This has nothing to do with the chiropractic. Eventually, I had to have that taken care of surgically, and so I had the three-level ACDF. And I no longer saw Dr. Aragona, but after that, when I returned, I thought, these bones, some of the ones that were not fused and everything, so it wasn't just my neck that was being treated at Dr. Aragona's. They kept going back into place, and they slowly were getting better, but really not a lot. These deformities are just kind of the way that I am, it seems like. But the massage really seemed to be something there. I don't know how to explain it. But my tissues got very bad, and the only thing that seemed to help it at all was a very heavy duty massage. And that is the way that went for a number of years. And what that really was the inkling of my discovering was fascia, that this was the fascia that was, distorting my body and causing me so much pain. I didn't know that then, of course, not even close. Certainly we didn't have the research that I'm about to tell you about now, which is going to be the structure and the function of fascia, the types of fascia,
So first, there's going to be four types of fascia. Let's talk about them. Fascia comes in four types. There's the superficial fascia. There's the deep / muscular fascia. There's the visceral fascia and the neural fascia. Now, most of what's being published right now, at least by Professor Stecco's group out of the University of Padova, has been on the deep and muscular fascia, at least what I have seen. So I think there's quite a bit more that I have not seen. But what's coming out right now has to do with the deep / muscular fascia. Now, there are two types of deep / muscular fascia. There's the aponeurotic fascia, which is sort of the, if you think of these big sheaths of connective tissue, like at your abs or at opposite of your abs in your lower back, that big thick sheet of tissue there. There's also tissue in your legs that are like this. So this is the aponeurotic tissue, and it's a big, thick, well-defined sheet. And what specifically the fascia that they're using in these the experiments in this paper is the fascia lata, which is from the the hip leg area, kind of. So that was the aponeurotic fascia, these big, thick sheets. And then there's the epimysial fascia, which surrounds all muscle and also eventually forms the attachment, eventually to the bone. It's not really to the bone. It flows into what's called the periosteum, which is the outer. It's like the skin of the bone. And this periosteum is actually very, very sensitive. If you've ever had a piece of, I don't know, tool steel sitting against it as a fragment, as I have, you know when the doctor puts it there, and you know when he leaves it there, and you know once they remove it. So the periosteum is very sensitive. That's an aside, but the connective tissue flows right into it. Very, very, very interesting to find just that little tidbit out. That's how the muscle attaches to the bone, is the connective tissue just forms into the periosteum. All right, that's the epimysial fascia, along with the stuff that just surrounds the muscle. So those two, the aponeurotic and epimysial, are deep fascia, muscular fascia. There's also the superficial fascia, which is directly underneath the skin and the initial skin fat layer. There is the visceral fascia, which sort of divides the internal compartments of the body and holds all of the organs in place. I think mesentery maybe is another word for that sometimes. And then there are all the neural fascia that they specifically mention cover the peripheral nerves and are the meninges. So the meningeal layers are neural fascia. And so I assume that will eventually sort of explain what happened in my neck there. That was the really super bad pain there at one point. All right. Another thing that we're going to talk about here, functions of fascia. Most importantly is my opinion, right? Not what this paper says. but I think if you search around and also I think the Steckos would agree with me too. But in my experience, fascia's mechanical function, period, end of story, is to determine the relative position of your bones. That is what it does. Now, I'm just understanding that this may be the basis of a tensegrity, so I'm going to have to check in on that. But in tensegrity models, that the bones are spacers, which is great. It's interesting. But first, what I'm saying is that what we care about on a day-to-day basis is that our ability to move and bend and the way in which we can move and bend, that's fascia. Second, and I think, every doctor is going to agree on this one, at least, because this is what they're taught, is that it's connective tissue. But it connects everything. And to the extent that has, just imagine all the cells of the body that are not fascia. You don't know about fascia at all. All the muscles, all the nerves, all of the everything except for the inside of the intestines where you have poop and the open tubes, that kind of thing. Everywhere else, between every single other cell, pretty much, is a fascial cell. Or, you know, some component of the fascia that's secreted, you know. So the fascia is like the background matrix. It is the scaffold of the body. And I don't really hear it being spoken about in that way. But it's innervated. Portions of it, it's innervated differently, but sections of it are innervated second only to the skin. So that's actually my point number three. It is a highly perceptive and proprioceptive organ. Its layers individually contain free nerve endings. Mechanically, it serves another purpose in transmitting load around the joint. It applies load to the, you know, the muscle can load and unload the fascia through the shear mechanism, and or not so much mechanism, but if you know these are layers stacked on top of each other, and their relative sliding is also determined by these layers that are as thin as 25 micrometers, 25 microns, which is a quarter of the thickness of a human hair. It's very, very thin. That layer is full of hyaluronic acid or hyaluronan, which is a lubricating substance of a variable molecular weight, similar to motor oil. The other thing that's really interesting about it, it contains these special cells that secrete this hyaluronic acid. Moreover, this group has published another paper back in 2020 that shows that if you feed those cells certain synthetic cannabinoids, that they will secrete hyaluronic acid because of the cannabinoid. So very interesting functions that this stuff has. For no one, you know, to have said anything to us about it before, right? So, wait, it determines where my bones are and how I move? Well, that sounds pretty important. I mean, you know, I don't know. Okay, so it's been a fundamental importance to me, and that's why I'm telling you guys about it. And I know it sounds crazy. all right. Let's talk about its structure a little bit, the structure of fascia. So it's sort of what, you know, I used to, a couple decades ago, worked on a programs that wanted to 3D print not just electronics, but also human tissue. And so they were always talking about a scaffold. And that is basically what the fascia is. It is a matrix for cells. And it's actually, it's more than that. It's also, you know, this larger structure and everything, but at its most basic level, it's a matrix, and then cells, and then this extracellular matrix, which is, you know, sort of the matrix sort of has two components. It's sort of like a composite. And one of those components is this hyaluronic acid, which can have this variable molecular weight. And the other is this fibrous, component, which can be a few different kinds of fibers. You're like, okay, where do those come from? I think that's a good question. Well, let's talk about them. Let's talk about what secretes them, and that's the cells. These cells are sort of like lodged in there, kind of shoved into this composite of woven collagen and elastin and myofibrils. So these cells are sitting in there, and they're called fibroblasts. And these fibroblasts are what secrete the collagen fibers. I don't think the process is super well known right now. But there's about 30% of those in quote-unquote healthy fascia, according to this paper, are fasciocytes, and those fasciocytes occur at the outermost interfaces of the fascia, four outermost interfaces in the three-layered fascia lata structure that they picture in the figure. And these cells specifically are the ones that secrete the hyaluronan, or maybe even secrete is not exactly the right word. This is a very basic cellular process. There are also another cell that is only briefly mentioned in this paper called a telocyte, and it seems to only be in the middle layer of the fascia of the three-layered fascia lata. And so it's interesting. They refer to it as being a network within a network, and that these cells can somehow communicate with one another. So you've got the cells. They're sitting in this fibrous matrix. And what else is in this fibrous matrix? Well, you have in this fibrous matrix free nerve endings, particularly in the innermost and outermost layers of a three-layered fascia lata, but notably not in the middle. And then also receptors. So there are various types of receptors that are for doing different things. You can think of these as, like inertial navigation units or pressure sensors and those sorts of things if you were going to put it on a robot. But these are made of meat and we're people. So same thing. So the extracellular matrix consists of two components. It's similar to a composite. It has a fibrous component, and there can be varying types of fibers, and then an aqueous component that has quite a varying characteristics all in of itself. But the authors describe the extracellular matrix, and I'll just take a few of their words, which are great, as a highly dynamic three-dimensional matrix. It contains collagens and proteoglycans, glycoaminoglycans, elastin, fibronectin, laminins, glycoproteins. It's sort of a complicated soup to make this kind of resin that goes around the fiber, but the most important GAG is this hyaluronan, which itself has a variable molecular weight. It's a pretty interesting molecule. They talk about it a little more in this paper, but and in references therein. But basically, it works as a motor oil and comes in varying viscosities that are also linked to inflammation and immunosuppression. So it's pretty interesting that the other thing about that the hyaluronan's viscosity is linked to inflammation, but the other thing that it's linked to the size and the viscosity are about this are sort of correlating functions. It stores water in copious amounts. The way it interacts with water is pretty interesting, and so it is able to really absorb a lot of water like a sponge, and I think that gives, again, this composite a very special sort of behavior. So first, let's talk about the fibers a little bit. They mentioned three main types of fibers in here. The main one by far is collagen fibers. These do not stretch. And the main types of collagen are type 1 and type 3. Type 1, I think, being the long, stiff, straight kind that helps transmit load. I still haven't been able to find where I read this, but I believe that the collagen fibers are among the longest fibers in the body, and that they are around 300 micrometers long. That's about three times the length of the diameter of a human hair. But I need to double check that. So if you want, check me out on that. The collagen fibers do not stretch, but there are also a stretchy variety of elastic fibers. These do not show up in the aponeurotic fascia. There's less than 1% of elastic fibers in the big thick sheets of the deep fascia that I talked about at the beginning of this segment. But in other fascias, there can be more, and it goes with, how much that fascia needs to comply. There's a third type of fibers that apparently only show up in low amounts of 1-2%. And they may have some kind of role in injury, but these fibers have the ability to contract. And there's not a lot written about them, but they are mentioned. And it's pretty interesting. So in general, you have this collagenous matrix of fibers that's sort of like, raw carbon fiber with no resin in it. So now that is the fibrous component of the ECM. The aqueous component of the ECM are all of those things that I discussed earlier, the proteoglycans, the hyaluronan, elastin, fibronectin. Where I have seen it before, I believe they also refer to these as mucosaccharides. And I think that's sort of an instructive description because it kind of gives you an idea of the mucus type consistency. And while it's not the sexiest thing of this particular organ system, I guess you'd say, I think it is a key component, and it is instructive to think about it in the terms of like mucus, and that all of the varying degree that it can, the varying forms that it can take just based on the amount of moisture that's in it, you know, it's crusty on your nose versus being all goopy. And so on and so forth. So if you imagine that that is the resin in a composite, the properties of that composite could vary quite a bit. Now, in terms of the function, the way that the way that it's built with the fibrous and the aqueous components, that can be just like with a composite. And the beauty of it is that you can ratio those, you know, the amount of fibers versus the amount of all of the other components, so that you get more of a goopy stuff versus more of a more like a tendon. And in fact, it's even further differentiation by how you align the fibers, just again like a composite, or how you weave them together, or how they get knitted together in some way. So all of this, it varies by function, location. The recent usage affects the fascia. There's certainly papers on that that show that it can be, you know, it's thickened with increased usage. It's a fascinating topic all by itself. And then the properties of all of these two components of this structural member are varied by hormones, pH, temperature, injury, disease, aging, and in particular, I think applicable to me, immobilization. So, you know, the final thing that I want to, when I talk about the ECM, when we talk about the ECM and everything else, I think it helps when we're thinking about the inanimate portion of fascia, when you're thinking about the ECM, when you're thinking about the part that is not the cells, it's not the nerves, it's more of the just this structure. This is the part that is everywhere. This is the part that's between everything else. This is the part that connects everything else. It contains all these variable amounts of glues to stick to that kind of cell, to stick to other kind of cells, to let this cell go through. It has all of these properties that vary throughout your entire body, from inside deep in your muscle, you know, in your legs, through in your heart, and then in your spinal column. And so it's quite a variable organ, but it's all connected into one continuous network. It's a continuum, all connected together. And I think that is a part that is the hardest for us to handle with this particular organ system, that it's just... it's a continuum. It flows into itself seamlessly and just varies in an analog sort of way. Okay, now finally with fascia, the another thing to consider, and this was just recently published, and I've mentioned this in other shows and things, but by this same group, actually, same lead author, that fascia also responds to, the cells in fascia respond to a synthetic cannabinoid, two synthetic cannabinoids. They used at least two, maybe even three. I don't remember. I haven't looked at the paper in a while. But they found a synthetic cannabinoid that when they fed it to, it's a non-intoxicating one, that when they fed it to these special fasciocyte cells that I mentioned earlier, they secreted hyaluronic acid. So much like, you know, now we have this endocannabinoid system that most doctors are unaware of. It presumably has conditions and deficiencies like any other system of our body. Again, the doctors in science wouldn't be aware of those things, although folks like Ethan Russo have proposed certain things very helpfully, I think. But now we have this other new system, the fascia system. It has its own ailments Some of which we already know about, and many of which I think we probably don't because we don't understand this structure. But the reason why this show exists in the form that it does, and the reason why, you know, it's chronic pain, fascia, and the endocannabinoid system is this fact right here, that those fasciocytes contain the CB2 receptor and release hyaluronan whenever you stimulate it with a synthetic cannabinoid. I'll go over that paper maybe some other time, but it is a reference in this review article, and it will be referenced in the show notes. I think the good thing about both of these systems is that we've had them for millennia, and they have been healing themselves for millennia, so we don't really need to go out and manufacture these new silver bullets to go cure whatever is wrong with us. It's more like, let's fix what's wrong with the body, that it's not healing itself. All right. That was an extreme close-up of the bong. I tell you, I am the most unlikely consumer of cannabis. I was not... I'm still, like, I'm over it, okay, as far as recreation goes. Again, the results that I get make it like I would do anything pretty much to make this happen. So, let's say, you know, I'm from New Hampshire. I got my original first marijuana certification in New Hampshire and went to my first dispensary there, bought my first legal weed there, bought my first illegal weed, I mean, basically, there. You know, I've legally purchased in New Hampshire at one dispensary. It's all you can do without some paperwork. It's kind of weird. They only have three dispensaries the last time I was there. Anyway, so I bought in New Hampshire. Let's name them off. New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Oregon, Washington, California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Alaska. I got 10. So... I've got a little bit of experience, and I've gone to, in all but my home state, I've gone to more than one. I plan to go to one more here in Arizona. I've only been in one in Arizona, but they only just became recreational. And they didn't have reciprocity with other states. So let's talk about that first. So first of all, in virtually every state where it's legal for medical, with the exception of Maine, your card is not useful. Now, I heard maybe New Mexico was going to do it, but I don't think it's been enacted yet. You do not get medical in Massachusetts, even if you're a New Hampshire patient, but in Maine you do. And when I checked, Maine has reciprocity for many other states. 30 maybe, most of the medical states, if not all. So I think it's a really important thing. When you go to Maine, they treat you just like your main medical customer. When you go to any other state, they're going to treat you like a recreational customer. And let's say when that's in Massachusetts, that means that on top of the price that you see, or Arizona, you're going to pay somewhere between 20 you know, 10 to 20, maybe $30 additional in tax. Not every state taxes you like that. Alaska is kind of different, and maybe it's changed, and maybe I'm remembering wrong, but I'm virtually certain that in Alaska, they just showed me a different column of prices, and I just paid like $10 more, you know, which I think is it's the best thing to do if you're going to do anything, you know. I mean, the rest of these states making me go to the recreational, where in Massachusetts you don't get the test data like you do for the medical weed. You don't get the same kind of, you don't get the same products. So you can use the excuse that is to preserve their state's medical supply. But I would rather see it taken more like it is. And well, if it's truly medicine, hoarding it is not very ethical, in my opinion. Maybe I'm throwing that word around. What do I know about ethics? I'm telling you about weed, not ethics. I try to give you like a basic idea of what it's like for the first time to go and buy, give you an expectation. So in most states, you will get into a line. They may separate you out medical versus recreational. It may be separate facilities. They're going to check your ID, your card. In New Hampshire, you have to buzz a door and show a camera your ID and your cannabis card, and then they buzz you in. They don't say any words other than show your papers. You can't even come inside. And then once you get inside, so New Hampshire's, a lot of states, once you get inside, there's sort of a little holding area. That's not really the floor where the cannabis is, but it's a waiting area. Sometimes there's seating, most of the time there's not. They may also check your card in this location as well. And then you're going to go inside. And then what's inside is pretty variable. It can be as fancy looking as almost like an Apple store. I would say I went to one in, where was I? Maybe Indio, California, somewhere in SoCal. That was pretty fancy. It was, it wasn't in Indio. It was in Coachella. So, yeah, it was the Coachella dispensary, and the prices matched. And they had about, three products and not a lot of information on it, and that's what you get. And by the way, the taxes in Coachella are crazy. They're very, very high. I believe that's about the highest that I've seen. So they add a very substantial amount to you. In fact, the amount of tax is more than what a gram of extract costs in a lot of states.
Okay, let's talk about bud tenders and what bud tenders are and bud tenders are not. I would venture a guess that virtually 100% of bud tenders are pretty heavy weed smokers or people that are very experienced with smoking weed for whatever age they are. Now, to the extent that you consider that a qualification, I'll let you decide. For my purposes, it's not particularly helpful, other than from a usage type perspective. So as far as this is the equipment that works best for me, keeps me from coughing, lets me do this or that with it. So they typically have a lot of experience that way. And that has its value. And then a lot of them will have certain courses and things that are put out by, the people that are putting such educational materials out these days. The big thing in the industry right now that everyone talks about, because you can go pull a paper from Ethan Russo on it, and people have kind of taken that a lot of places with the terpenes, but it's terpenes, 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 terpenes. And so if you're into aromatherapy and everything, let me just suggest to you that marijuana is not the way to do it. Get yourself an essential oils kit, a quality one. And find a friend that's into oils, which shouldn't be too hard to do, and go take care of yourself that way. You don't need marijuana if that's the reason why you're using it, in my humble opinion. Yeah, bud tenders they're going to have a lot of information for you on the terpenes, and then they're going to say, no, it's the entourage effect. It'll tweak it so you get the marijuana effects too. All right, well, are we here for marijuana or are we here for terpenes? Because at least for me, terpenes just cause me to cough. I have been using concentrates, which, quite a bit easier to deal with in a lot of ways. And that has its own issues. But there I find a lot of help with the people in the dispensaries, with the bud tenders. And
But when it comes to finding specific cannabinoids or effects or anything else, boy, I want you to be extremely, extremely skeptical of anything that a bud tender tells you. I don't mean this to denigrate bud tenders in any way other than what it needs to be. I don't mean to denigrate, but I want people to be concerned because this is your health. I mean, but a lot of times these bud tenders and the attitude in the stores, not a lot of times, 99% of the stores, and I've been in, you know, now 11 states and like over two stores in each one on average probably. So I've been in quite a few stores across the nation from Alaska to New Hampshire to Southern California to Oklahoma. And I have had in all of those states bud tenders tell me things that were either highly skeptical, misinformed, or just plain wrong. Things like, I don't think our cannabis contains CBG because it's only outdoor grown. That's not particularly dangerous or anything, but it's just annoying because of the amount of misinformation that's out there. And people really want to, they're aware of this, you know, they're aware of the benefits of what cannabis can do, but we, you know, they don't have the ability to express it. And I think that is typically where we're at with bud tenders. And, but if you go in and just, you know, let them know that, you know, hey, look, I don't really think your terpene knowledge is going to be helpful for me, but what I would like to know is about specifically about your products, and can you tell me how they're labeled? Does this state have more than just a THC label? Okay, this is a question that you can ask a bud tender. Can I see your labels? Can I touch your product? Can you open it for me? Some states you are not allowed to touch the packaging. Some states they can open it up and let you smell it and walk away with it if you want. It's kind of, or not walk away with it, but you know, it's highly variable, and for concentrates in particular, that matters. And I think for flower it does too, you know, for freshness and everything. All right, so now you're looking at the label with them. And so, okay, first of all, you can ask for test results. In very few states, they might have, you know, I really love Alaska for this. The dispensaries that I went to, they had their test results right there. I could just pick up a book and look through it, and they thanked me to do so. And it was excellent. It was, it's great that way. And New Hampshire does that too. They have it online, and they have great tests. Most states, the only testing that you're going to be able to get real time when you go into the dispensary, and I need to give you this expectation because you're not going to get it while you're there and you're spending big money, is the test results that are on the packaging. So they're going to have to physically go and get each one of these, and you're going to have to know what you want. And it's very inconvenient. I recommend that you go into a dispensary with a game plan, pretty much knowing what strains you think you're going to get. So the kinds of test results that you're going to get in every state, definitely you will get a THC content. And a lot of things, I think that's the only thing they measure, because the CBD will come back at 0.0. And I feel like, you know, it needs to be either LOQ or, maybe it really is 0.0 a tenth of a percent, but that seems low. Maybe some plants really don't have that. This is the extent of my knowledge. So anyways, you could probably, maybe we could say even that you can get THC and CBD in each one. Beyond that, highly, highly variable what else you're going to get. Very few states will have very many, require very many terpenes to be listed. Again, if you want to focus on terpenes and go on the smell and everything else, I really recommend you go to aromatherapy. You're wasting your money on something that is intoxicating and expensive. The other cannabinoids, CBG, CBC, CBN, not very many states have those tested. And if you can, here's your strategy when you first go in, and to be prepared. You need to know what test results you can get. And you can call ahead and ask, and maybe they can give you the links and things that they tell you when you walk in. This has been my experience, because I just walk into dispensaries, so I'm driving by or whatever, and they go, oh, well, we can get it for you and email it to you, or that sort of thing. You know, again, not very helpful. But that's the kind of level of support that you can expect in general from bud tenders around the country. And again, I'm not denigrating them. And again, you know, what you're paying them McDonald's employees wages, I'm sure. So you're going to get a McDonald's employee. That said, this person is there to help you, and they generally do want to help you and will generally do their best to help you. There are a few, as I mentioned, you should be aware of, I just want to, you know, keep that perspective in mind for people when they go into a dispensary. The other thing, so there's going to be a lot of different products, types, and if we're not here for recreation, so I think edibles and cookies and anything like that, unless you need that for some particular medical reason, like for just nausea or something that we're treating here, I don't think those are a particularly useful vehicle. I don't find them to be very repeatable. I don't find the edible pathway to be something that's going to give me feedback. But if you're going to use that, I would recommend you use pills or drops, you know, from oils or something like that. Keeping in mind that it's much more intoxicating to ingest marijuana than it is to consume it in other ways, because of the conversion that takes place in the liver to something called 11-hydroxy-THC, if I remember correctly. So, and that's the limitation that I find with it. And also, I don't know that all the cannabinoids survive the digestive system or go on, or, you know, and in my case, I don't think that the mechanism works anywhere near the same unless I take an immediate, you know, like large amount of it all at once. Now, so that has its own effects on your lungs, and I'm not saying it's causing me problems necessarily, but it's, you know, certainly not something I would advise people do, go out and take up a bong habit. Anyway, I'm getting a little bit off topic.
So whenever I say that you need to be prepared whenever you go in and know what strains you're going to buy, I mean specifically to that dispensary, you need to have gone to that store's either their website or their weed maps, and preferably you need to have gone to both. Check out both, make a list, make a budget. You're going to need to know how much cash to bring. And I would suggest to you that for your very first trip that you go and buy the biggest range of products that you can possibly get. Go get one that's 100% medical grade CBD. Go get one that is, you know, extremely high in THC. Go get one that has every novel cannabinoid you can possibly get by itself. So, you know, if you notice that there's one strain that they're growing that happens to have CBN, and another one, you know, or because that happens in older strains, and that is a useful cannabinoid that you should definitely check out, CBN. And in my experience, it doesn't make you sleepy, but it's neither here nor there. As far as the cannabinoids go, try and explore as much as you can, and notice which ones help and which ones don't. And this starts getting into the nature of experiments and your own perception and how to handle all that, and I want to tell you about that in other shows. You know, depending on what you can afford, you know, pre-rolls is a good way to do it, but it's not very efficient in terms of medicating. That's a pretty low delivery in my experience. So anyway, we can talk about those sorts of things later, but if you want to start with pre-rolls, it's not the worst.
The point is to consider what methods you're going to use, and then how we're going to buy products that are going to help us in an experiment. And the expectation needs to be, if you are more than 5 years down the road with a chronic pain condition, you want to do something, you don't know what, you don't know how marijuana is going to work for you or whatever, you need to go in and do a proper experiment. And that means that you need to weigh your doses. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. And you need to choose a selection of weed based on not what gets the guy behind the counter the most high or any of that stuff, other than, you know, hey, can you give me one that gives a really heady head high? This is the sort of question you can ask a counter stoner, which I sometimes call the bud tenders. But they'll tell you which one will get you most high. They'll tell you which one will get you, has the lowest CBD. They'll tell you, so I just had an interaction in Nevada, and it was actually a really good one, and is a really good and helpful bud tender, but just part of the confusion that gets there. I look specifically for CBG. Notably, this is different than CBGA. That's the acidic form, and it does matter which one you get, and sometimes they test for one and not the other, and a lot of other things. So that was the case here, where they had tested this particular one that he liked, for me, for my purposes, after I told him what I was looking for. And again, this is what they're really good at, because, you know, they're familiar with the product selection there. That is the strength of the bud tender, okay? They're familiar with the product selection where you work, where you live, or where you're going to the dispensary. And so you kind of go in and tell them what you're looking for. In my case, it's CBG. Maybe in your case, you're looking for something relaxing, and they can tell you about the terpenes and everything. And a little more of the nuanced effects. But if you're looking to treat a specific illness with a specific cannabinoid, you need to know the difference that CBGA is not CBG. Now, it is true, and so this was his name was Justin, and he's a well-educated bud tender, top tier. He was like, well, when you combust that, it does turn to CBG, and he is correct by that, at least to the extent that I also know that all these acidic forms, they get decarboxylated whenever you burn them, and the acid comes off, and that's the thing you ingest. But still, in my case, I don't need CBGA. I know that for a fact. I need it to be CBG, and so I don't know. I get cranky with these guys sometimes, guys and gals, sometimes, but it's all good. The bud tenders, they are generally, you know, enthusiastic, and they want to, when it's helped you, they want to know, because they want to tell other people, and they, you know, it's a lot more than you get out of most other industries. So I appreciate them. And I don't mean, when I say these harsh things about them, I don't mean to be negative, but I mean to put everything in perspective.
What you need to do is plan on creating a dose, for sure. This is the plan, and being able to follow that in a dosing regime. You need to treat yourself like a doctor would treat you. Were they able to prescribe or had any knowledge on this medicine? So now you're going to develop your own information on it. And the most important thing you have is the ability to take it and the ability to measure it. If you choose oil, then I think, you don't need to care so much about buying a scale, maybe at least in the beginning. But if you're going to use any of these other methods, you're going to smoke anything or inhale anything, plan on buying a scale. And plan on buying a 0.001 gram resolution scale. So you want a scale with a resolution of 0.001 gram. That's also known as a milligram, or 1/1000th of a gram. You can get cheapo little scales like this on Amazon, and they have a lower usable limit on the order, in my experience, of about 20 to 35 milligrams. I'm pretty hard on my scales. They get thrown around and dropped and carried different places. They seem to have, you know, sometimes you get one that's much better than the others, and I think that's just the nature of the beast. And then you can spend whatever you want. But keep in mind, when we start talking about measuring a milligram, things like, at least, you know, maybe in advance, a little special situation, but if I move, you know, it changes the suspension angles enough to change my measurements. So I have to be cognizant of that, cognizant of tilting things, cognizant of if I'm not on the level surface, that all my measurements are off. That is one big advantage over sticks and bricks life. The other thing is, I got, after pretty much Michigan last year, I think. I pretty much stopped weighing because my dosage got down below the noise floor of the scale. So I'm kind of in microdosing territory these days, even though I'm taking these big long dabs. You know, it's 20 milligrams of CBG and like 10 milligrams of full spectrum, something like that.
Right, I feel if I've kept you on here this long and through all that ticking, you've listened to the other episodes maybe and heard that ticking before. That's my heater, and that's my furnace. It's the fuel pump to the furnace, actually. And there are a lot of ways to quiet it down. Mine just happens to be mounted in a very acoustically inappropriate spot. My heater install is pretty crazy. Anyway, thank you guys for listening, and I really hope that you have take away something from the time that you have spent with me. I hope to provide this kind of content for you, and hopefully with guests that can explain things a lot better than my stumbling through fields that are simply not mine. But I did want to kind of leave you with a vision of how it all works in my mind. And the fascia, as what we're starting to come to know, is just a fascinating organ system. You go to the doctor's office or to your massage therapist and look at that, the body standing there without the fascia on it. And you see the muscles, and it's all got the shape and everything there. And poof, so imagine it, please, with all the organs. Imagine it fully, with whatever you have in mind of the way animals are built inside. Put all that in there underneath the muscles and everything, and then all the brain and everything else, and then poof, I want you to imagine it go away. But there's like a ghost there. The shape is still retained. And in fact, all of that stuff that you were just thinking of, none of that stuff is responsible for the shape, other than the bones, which are really just spacers. The real thing that we're talking about here is that ghost. What makes that shape? Well, it is a fascinating, fascinating structure. And down at its small scale, roughly the size of a human hair kind of scale, it is a composite of that would be the longest fibers in there, I believe, would be about 300 microns long. I'm kind of spitballing here, but that's my understanding. And so the collagen fibers and the collagen, and these are in woven into some form of a composite like matrix, as we would do as humans. Typically, they in the very load-bearing areas like tendons, they become very linear and aligned, but less so in the other structures. And that's the fibrous component of this structure. Then there's this aqueous component in there that's, let's call it the resin. And basically, it's just it is everything that you could think of in a normal, if you're a composite person, and I happen to know a few. I'm not one myself, but they care a lot about their resins. And imagine one that is basically like the next generation Terminator 2. It's not liquid metal anymore. It is just a variable resin that can be a solid if you don't agitate it too hard, and then it'll turn to liquid if you do. That's a thixotropy component. It can be this lubricious material that can also set up into a solid. And isn't that what the liquid mercury, robot looking thing is? And then again, we are just talking about the, so this is like a inanimate, components of this structure, again, of this ghost that forms our shape. So these are secreted by now cells that are embedded in this extracellular matrix, as it's called, which is this combination of the fibers and the variable molecular weight stuff and the glycosaminoglycans, the GAGs. And all these other, they call them proteoglycans. So these are sort of like simple types of sugar-type molecules, little protein pieces on them, and different conformations of those, I believe. So that's your structure, and within that you have the cells embedded in there in a variable sort of way, and there's all these different cell populations.
And so that is the fine structure of the fascia with the cells in the fibrous matrix. And in the larger structure, like the fascia lata and the picture that the main figure that's shown in the journal article, there is the three-layered structure, not counting the interstitial spaces between there that are the very thin layers that are 25 microns thick, each of which is primarily full of the hyaluronic acid. Which is in probably a different form. I believe it is in a different form. I believe I read somewhere that it's sulfated. I'm not sure that matters. So this three-layered structure made out of these this fibrous composite that I've been describing to you in the fascia lata, the outer two layers, imagine those two, and the outer edges of those two layers, that's where the fasciocytes reside. So on the innermost and the outermost layers. The middle layer, there are no fasciocytes, is what this paper is saying. And the fasciocytes are the ones that generate the hyaluronic acid when the CB2 receptor is activated with the synthetic cannabinoid. And it's the properties of these layers, their tensile properties, their abilities to expand and contract, their conformity, their ability to slide past each other, their ability to perceive, all of that is our ability to move, our proprioception, or very large portions of it. And I can just tell you from my experience that what I thought was arthritis and everything that I thought was joint pain, and really a lot of other pain that I am still just getting used to not having around anymore, but the original joint pain and everything, the last of that, for the most part, drained out of my neck in a single event as a liquid. And it was a moment that I will not forget. And it's really kind of changed the way that I think about how the body works. And that was before these papers came out. So... You know, this research work for me personally, it means quite a bit because I can sort of recast some of what's happened to me in framework that actually involves understanding instead of just my perception. And that is very helpful for me. I hope it is in some way helpful to the listener. I thank you for listening to me kind of meander through the last 20 years. Every time I get on here, I try and make a point, and there are so many side points and little important things that I feel I need to tell you. But I hope that this show is useful for you in all aspects, and I hope that if you are a chronic pain patient that you can, you know, begin to put together and some kind of image of what being better would look like to you. It really starts with that. You have to have some kind of image of what it is that you would even want as better, and just start fleshing that out and let it grow and evolve and turn into this big grand image, hopefully. Prepare yourself also with those other questions as far as, you know, what are you willing to do, and are you willing to accept all of the unintended stuff that's going to happen, or all of the things, the unanticipated is really the right word here, is there's going to be a lot of things you can't anticipate by getting better, and you're going to learn some things about the relationships that you have, especially. Anyway, that's just part of it, and it will stop you if you're not prepared for it, so you still want to get better, don't you? And then, as far as fascia goes, I just hope that I've done the author's work, you know, some kind of justice, and I haven't gotten it too wrong. I would definitely recommend, if you can, to go take a look at the papers, to use the links in the show notes. Go check out the papers and read for yourself, and use that information directly rather than what you hear from me. And then finally, on cannabis, sort of the same situation. There's so much to explain. There's a lot more I'd like to discuss with you.
I know that most folks would like to have some really detailed instructions on do this, this, and this. This isn't going to be that podcast for you. I'm not really a prescriptive person like that. What I really need to teach you to do, well, other than, you know, I'm trying to teach you with these questions to be as explicit as I can, but what I'm trying to teach you to do is figure out how to make yourself better, because I think you can get better, and I think we just need to figure out how to make our bodies work to heal themselves. Cheers.